Of course, Soul Stream. So if you want to hear some funky jams, come on down.
In between the band, yeah. Relly Rolls will be holding it down.
Yeah. Some 80s funk.
Get at them for guest list.
Yeah.
All right, Tash, thanks for rolling through. We're creeping on the next show, so we got to bounce. It's been Crimes and Treasons. Peace.
Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi everyone, and welcome to my science project on May 1st. I think that's what it is anyway, 2008. Welcome to May, and this is my science project. This is CITR 101.9 in Vancouver on the FM dial. And today's show is a little bit of a sports and arts roundup. I've got all kinds of silly science stories coming from sports. You know, it's sort of springtime. I'm seeing the kids in the park. I'm seeing them playing baseball. I'm seeing them playing golf. It's that time of year. And so I found some fun stuff about sports. And we look at the judgment and perception with the help of some tennis and baseball playbacks and some quirky science stories from the golf fairway. And then in terms of arts, I'm going to kick back to a show that I did back in December where we were looking at the ways in which genes can be translated into music. It's sort of a tip of the hat to generative art, and I think it's going to be part one of a couple segments on generative art. I'm hoping to have an interview for you with Jer Thorpe, a local generative artist, in my coming show in 4 weeks' time. So, like I said, we're going to start out with some springtime tennis fever, and to get you in the mood, here is Cream.
Twice upon a time, in the valley of the tears, the auctioneer is bidding for a box of fading ears, and the elephants are dancing. For tennis, wouldn't that be nice? And the ice creams are all melting on the streets of bloody beer, while the beggars stain the pavements with fluorescent Christmas cheer. And the Bentley driving guru is putting up his price. Anyone for tennis, wouldn't that be nice? Thank you.
You're listening to My Science Project, CITR's favorite science and technology show. That was Cream with Anyone for Tennis, and I'm playing that because it's springtime and everyone's getting outdoors and playing them their sports. So also coming up will be a lot of big tennis competitions, including Wimbledon. So next time you're watching Wimbledon, consider this. You are watching a scientific experiment in progress, or so says George Mather of the University of Sussex. Mather has been using tennis and the introduction of the Hawkeye to tennis in order to study the visual limitations of perception. For most of the history of tennis, a contentious line call would not be reconsidered. The line judge's call would stand unless an umpire could get a better look at the ball or a ball had left a mark on the clay court surface. Enter the Hawkeye, a new line calling system that uses several high-speed cameras to capture every bounce and pinpoint a ball within 3 millimeters, enabling a more clear in or out call. The Hawkeye has changed tennis and elicited some very strong opinions in the process. Official rules now allow players to make 2 unsuccessful challenges per set, during which the umpire defers to the Hawkeye outcome. A replay of the point reviewed, complete with heavy anticipation and audience providing a crescendo of soundtrack, are hallmarks of the Hawkeye in play. But our scientist, George Mather, saw this new technology as experimental data, and it's experimental data generated by the players and by the officials. Mathers has analyzed data from 15 men's professional tournaments that included 1,473 challenges made by 246 players. He was able to verify what we would all expect. The closer the call, the higher the error rate. Players and linesmen were most likely to misjudge balls landing within 5 millimeters of the line. The farther the ball was from the line, the fewer the errors. Mathers used this data to create a mathematical model of line calling based on human perception of fast-moving objects. We do our best to pinpoint the ball, but when we're reaching a decision about exactly where a ball is, our brain will not always come up with the same answer. Because of this ambiguity, the typical rate of misjudgment is 8.2%, according to Mather, and that's 8.2% of all balls that land within 10 centimeters of the line. This could mean up to 4 incorrect calls per set, so tennis players are wise to trust their instincts and mount some challenges. But there are some further interesting questions that stem from the study and aren't clearly answered in the publication. For example, do line judges and umpires have a tendency to err on the side of the stronger player? Are there more challenges during tighter matches? Regardless, the Hawkeye is there to settle tough disputes. Baseball, on the other hand, has been concerned with the consistency of calls from their umpires in recent years. There's no Hawkeye in play, but you might expect that research into this issue would come from the United States, home of the great ball game. But in this case, I have some Canadian content for you. In a recent publication, Clara McMahon of Victoria University, Melbourne, Australia, and Janet Starks of McMaster University in Ontario reported on the contextual differences on the ball strike decision. Here's how they tested it. Provided with a comfy chair and a whole bunch of video clips, participants that included umpires, players, and control participants with no previous baseball experience were asked to call balls and strikes based on the clips that they were shown. They first examined basic judgment, free from any deliberate influences. Participants were simply shown clips and asked to call the pitches. As you might expect, umpires and players were significantly more accurate with their calls than were the inexperienced controls. But how would the participants perform in more of a game-like situation when they knew that the pitch count was 3 balls to 2 strikes, or 3 balls to 0 strikes, and then they saw a tough pitch? Or how would the participants perform if borderline pitches were shown after viewing a definite ball or a definite strike? All participants in the study performed similarly in direct information tasks. For example, participants called target pitches closer to the strike end of the scale when viewed after definite balls, then when viewed after definite strikes. Also, if the pitch count was 3-0 or 3-2, all participants were more likely to call a borderline pitch a strike. These findings indicate that the standard for evaluation changes based on the context in which stimuli are processed. Moreover, the strength of the contextual factors is illustrated in that the effects were shown in observers with and without experience in the task. As for the umpires, this study emphasizes their tendency to, quote-unquote, hasten the game by calling more strikes than other participants. It's says those umpires really love to call the strikes, no matter what they've seen first. And I also mentioned golf. I've got a couple of a collection of quirky golf science stories for you. First is going to be helpful to you if you're thinking about what kind of golf bag to buy. The title of this article was "The Metabolic Cost of Carrying a Single Versus Double Strap Golf Bag." Serious decisions for those golfers out there, but Ikeda, Cooper, Gulick, and Nguyen of University of Montana and also from Family Hospital in Washington, in Spokane, Washington, have got a very clear answer for you. The purpose of their study was to compare energy expenditure and perceived comfort using two modes of carrying a golf bag. 15 men competed two trials of walking on a treadmill while carrying a golf bag. During one of the trials, an extra strap was added to convert a single strap bag to a double strap bag. The order was randomized so that some people got the one strapper first and others got the two strapper first. Regardless, oxygen consumption, heart rate, perceived exertion, and perceived comfort were measured during the 5-minute walk. Oxygen consumption was significantly lower carrying the double strap bag, as was heart rate, and similarly the rate of perceived exertion. During the double strap trial, the perceived comfort level was higher. So if you're trying to make your decision and you're expecting some long games, the double strap bag is the way to go, and improvements in metabolic demands and comfort while carrying a double strap golf bag should increase walking tolerance in golf. So there you have the first of a couple of funny little stories. Another one here is a longitudinal study of choking in professional golfers. And we're not talking about dining at the course here, talking about choking under pressure. And this is a piece of research that came out of University of North Texas. The study followed the performance of 35 professional golfers who played from 1997 to 2004 on the PGA Tour. And it investigated whether any players were prone to choke when placed in a high-pressure situation. Choking in this case was defined as a player having significantly higher than expected final round scores and being less likely than other professional golfers to win when in contention to win tournaments. This is the choking under pressure hypothesis that was tested in this manuscript. Analysis has yielded no support for the choking under pressure hypothesis. None of the players, when in contention to win, were both more likely to have higher than expected scores in the final round and less likely to win than other professional golfers in the sample. Limitations of the study were also examined more carefully. And finally, I've got one more for you, and it's on the suitability of golf course ponds for amphibian metamorphosis when bullfrogs are removed. So, as you are well aware, golf courses have pretty high environmental impact on their surroundings, and managing areas designed for human recreation so that they're compatible with nature and also compatible with amphibian populations can reduce the negative impact of habitat destruction from golf courses. And so in this paper, it was the potential for amphibians to complete larval development was examined in golf courses in the presence and absence of bullfrog tadpoles. And what they found is that the bullfrogs are indeed limiting the development of non-bullfrog amphibians, and also that the increased survival is attributed to a lower abundance of insect predators on golf courses when the bullfrogs are absent. So there you have it, a roundup of springtime sports science stories and another springtime sport tune for you from Bruce Springsteen.
Home team. just 2 to 2. Well, Nella Keller knew just what to do. Well, just to cheer up the boys, she knew. She made the gang sing this song. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Oh, won't you buy me some peanuts and some Cracker Jack?
This is My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and that was a little roundup of spring sports science stories. A magical combination, if you ask me, but here's one for the scientists. If you're looking for someone to blame for your next failed experiments, why not point the finger at Mother Earth? Research published this week in Nature shows that chemical reactions can be influenced by magnetic fields as weak as the Earth's. This might allow you to transfer some blame for an experiment that went wrong, but what's really important about this finding is that it can apply to a gap that really needed explanation in terms of animal navigation. Many animals are thought to use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, including not only birds, but also mammals, fish, and even lobsters. There are two not necessarily exclusive theories about how they do this. One theory says that animals use magnetite minerals to somehow sense magnetic field direction. The other theory holds that birds might see a magnetic field using their eyes. For this to be perceived, there would have to be some sort of chemical reaction of molecules in the eyes that could be influenced by the direction of magnetic field lines. Until now, there's been no evidence that such a reaction could be influenced by a field as weak as that produced by the Earth. Now, an international team led by Christiane Timmel and Peter Hoare at the University of Oxford has demonstrated that this is possible. The specific materials that they used to show this do not occur naturally, but now that a chemical compass mechanism has been proven possible in principle, researchers can delve further to try and pin down the true culprit in biological systems. Hoare and Timmel's team looked at a material made of carotenoid and porphyrin and a fullerene, simply because it had the right mix of odd characteristics needed to investigate the question at hand. They shone green light at the material to trigger a known reaction that rearranges electrons around the molecule into several distinct stages. They could keep an eye on how long the molecule spent in the intermediate stage by watching the reaction using spectroscopy. The amount of time spent as this intermediate was different as magnetic field strength changed, they found. This was true for magnetic fields of 50 microtesla or less, comparable with the Earth's. They then set out to test whether the alignment of the molecules within the magnetic field also affected the chemical reaction. This kind of directionality is necessary if an animal is using a chemical reaction to detect north and fly in the right direction. The team embedded some molecules in a liquid crystal, making sure that they were all aligned in the same direction. From this, they confirmed that the amount of time spent as an intermediate was different depending on how the molecules were aligned in the magnetic field. Hoare says their team is now looking at the possibility of investigating cryptochromes, the molecules they have found in bird eyes that are suspected to have a role in the biological chemical compass. So there you have it. Something that could affect your scientific experiments is the Earth's magnetic surface, and it may have a significant impact on how we understand the ability of animals to use magnetic poles to direct their navigation. So big news this week is all about scientists on drugs. The journal Nature launched a poll online in January of this year, trying to find out whether scientists use drugs for enhancement of their instrument being the brain. Turns out that 1 in 5 Nature readers participating in the poll self-reported the use of drugs such as Ritalin, Provigil, and Inderal to enhance their mental performance. The poll also revealed that 80% of readers responding to the poll that regarded themselves as professional thinkers also thought that other professional thinkers should be allowed to use drugs to enhance their cognitive performance. So 80% are okay with this practice. So with respect to the poll, 1,400 people responded. And like I said, about 20% admitted to using drugs to improve concentration. But oddly, nearly two-thirds said that they knew of a colleague who did. And 70% said they'd boost their brain power by taking a cognitive-enhancing drug. The most common reasons given for the drug use was to improve concentration, to improve focus, or to counteract jet lag. In terms of frequency, about 25% said they used it daily, 25% that said they used the drugs weekly, 25% said monthly, and another quarter said only once a year. Most users scored the effect of the drugs at 3 or 4 out of 5, where 1 is a mild effect and 5 is a large effect. And over half of the users said the drug had side effects that they did not like. These sorts of drugs are being more commonly used by shift workers as well as military personnel. But if, for example, the modest benefits of such drugs are similar to those achieved with a double espresso, should it be regulated? Should it be and regarded as cheating? Certainly an espresso is not. Although this was not a scientific study, it certainly raises some provocative questions about whether such drug taking constitutes cheating. Here is We Are All on Drugs by Weezer.
Break for school, cause you think you're really cool when you're
This is CITR 101.9 FM, and you're listening to My Science Project. It is with a bit of sadness that I report an obituary today of Albert Hofmann, who died on April 29th, just a couple days ago. And as some of you may well be aware, Albert Hofmann was the discoverer of LSD, or lysergic acid diethylamide, in 1938. He then discovered its psychopharmacological effects 5 years later, after actually discovering the drug when he, quote-unquote, accidentally ingested the substance. But we'll leave that up to your imagination. Although Hofmann would take LSD numerous times throughout his life, he advocated precaution of its use and the value of the drug for the ability to assist contemplation and foster a sense of oneness with with nature. On a spring day in a Swiss forest at the age of about 8, Albert Hofmann claims to have had a beautiful and defining experience where he first experienced this union with nature without the assistance of drugs. This incident is described in his book, LSD, My Problem Child. He studied chemistry in Zurich and later, ironically, coincidentally rather, discovered LSD while studying the ergot fungus, which grows on rye kernels. Hofmann's experience with both accidentally and intentionally ingested LSD have led to the first scientific documentations of both good and bad LSD trips. Dr. Hofmann produced other important drugs, including methergine that is used to treat hemorrhaging, but of course it was LSD that shaped his career. As head of the pharmaceutical company Sandoz, he led up their Department of Research for Natural Medicines. This included numerous experiences as a participant in psychedelic and shamanistic rituals in southern Mexico. He succeeded in synthesizing the active compounds in the psilocybe mexicana mushroom and in isolating the active compound in morning glory seeds used by the Mesotec. Despite numerous wild and experimental acid trips, Albert Hofmann continually campaigned for the responsible but legalized use of LSD. He felt that it should be used and treated in the way that primitive societies treat psychoactive sacred plants, ingested with care and for spiritual intent. Dr. Hofmann died on April 29th at his hilltop home near Basel, Switzerland, at the age of 102. With plasticine pauses, with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile. The girl with kaleidoscope eyes. I want to move in now to what will probably be the first installment of a couple on generative art. During the latter half of the 18th century and the earlier half of the 19th century, some copies of musical games, called in my botch German, Musikalische Würfelspiel, were published in many cities all over Europe. All the publishers stated that an infinite number of compositions could be written by any amateur, even if he or she were not familiar with the techniques or rules of composing. The tools recommended to select the musical figures were either a dice, or two, or three, or tops with six or nine-sided sided faces, in assistance with some numeral tables. The musical styles were usually dances or marches. The compositions were limited either to a single melody without accompaniment, to two lines for clavier, or to three lines for trio scoring. Several kinds of these musical games were published under the name of Mozart. There's an autographed, genuine musical game by Mozart in the Bibliothèque Nationale of Paris. And it's not been recorded, but it is certainly one of the earliest examples that we have of generative art, the use of dice or another set of rules to produce a musical or artistic output. These days, much more complex musical games can be played through computers, and they're designed to employ very sophisticated algorithms to produce incredibly beautiful art and intriguing music. In generative art, a systems-based approach is used, and ground rules are defined to generate an autonomous process that produces an artistic outcome. In my next radio installment, I'll present an interview with a Vancouver generative artist named Jarrah Thorpe. But today I thought it would be a good opportunity to revisit one of my previous shows on genes and music. In the excerpt that you're about to hear, I present a number of artists and scientists who've used gene and protein sequences to produce music. Takahashi is a graduate student in molecular genetics who has studied the piano since she was a child. And she's recently developed a method for converting genetic sequences to audio sounds as part of an undergraduate project for her supervisor, Jeffrey Miller. She says they were inspired in part by a blind meteorology graduate student at Cornell University in New York who developed a way of reading weather maps by converting different color gradations of a map into a range of tones. So in other words, Takahashi wanted to create a way for people to engage and learn about proteins and genes without actually using their eyes, and in this case, by using their ears. So a little bit of background in biology might be required to really get into this sound experiment. And here are the basics. So our genetic code, or our DNA, is made up of a sequence of just four different components, and those components are called nucleotides. It is the unique sequence of these building blocks that codes for the proteins that make up our body. So DNA provides the code for protein. Even though there are only four different components in DNA, proteins can be made up of a unique sequence of amino acids, and there's many more than four. So the jump in complexity from four single building blocks of DNA to as many as 20 different building blocks of protein is possible because the DNA code is not read one nucleotide at a time. It's actually read in a combinations of three at a time. So instead of coding for just four independent things, the four possible building blocks of DNA, when read three at a time, can code for up to 64 different things. So in other words, there's four possibilities in the first position, four in the second, and four in the third, giving a total possible outcomes of 64. So as I mentioned just a moment ago, there's actually 20 amino acids, so the full complexity of 64 is not necessary. But it is the sequence of these 20 amino acids in proteins that prescribe the music made by Takahashi and her supervisor, Miller. A simple song has been constructed, actually by another group in this case, based on the way that three nucleotides of DNA encode a single amino acid. In this piece, you can hear trios made from the letters A, C, T, G actually being chanted in the song, followed by a strong beat and accompanying letter that represents the encoded amino acid itself. This piece is called Code Table, and I'm going to let you have a listen to that and just digest the concept of DNA encoding protein. Thank you. What you've just been listening to is Code Table, rather a very literal interpretation of the DNA code and how it can encode different amino acids. And if you really got into listening to that, you could probably hear the ascribed letters to the building blocks of DNA, A, C, T, G, being read out in groups of three. And those are the groups of three that encode amino acids. So one way to actually make music from a protein sequence would be a direct one-to-one composition system, where one amino acid corresponds to one note. So in this case, music would be made up of a total of 20 notes, which could possibly span up to 2.5 octaves. So Takahashi and Miller did a small experiment with a protein called Phi-A, and this protein was encoded in the one-to-one composition system. And you'll see that it's actually quite a simple outcome. So have a listen to the single-note interpretation of the protein Phi-A. Was a one-to-one composition system for Phi-A, and as you could hear, the results of this coding strategy or musical translation strategy, where one amino acid corresponds to a single note within a 2.5 octave range, is actually quite simple, and it lacks a lot of musicality, it lacks very much depth. What it does give you a sense of is the variety of amino acids that make up this protein. So to expand on the complexity and the musical output of their translation systems, Miller and Takahashi created music of three-note chords by building thirds off of the original single note. And this creates sort of a fuller sound, as you'll hear in just a minute. But music has a lot more than just sounds to it, and rhythm is something that you might want to include. And to create rhythm, they looked at codon distribution. Now, codon is a trio of nucleotides encoding a single amino acid. So most codons will appear numerous times in a single gene. And so what they did was counted the frequency of a codon within a gene and assigned a note duration based on the frequency. And in this way, rhythm was created. So what you'll hear now is Phi-A, the same gene as you just heard in the one-to-one assignment, but in a more complex coding approach. And you'll see that it's much more complex and interesting tune. So what you can see with that DNA generative art is that there are a lot of sources of the systems and algorithms or rules that can be applied in the generation of interesting, if not absolutely fabulous, music. Coming up in my next show, like I said, I'll be interviewing Jared Thorpe, a local, more visual artist who uses algorithms to produce really outstanding and beautiful pieces of art. So before I wrap up the show today, I just wanted to let you know about a few events and things that are coming up in the science world, science community around Vancouver. Of course, Science World is one of the leaders in programming science programming, and their summer science camps are about to launch. And they'll offer something that almost no other science, no other camp can, and that's the science-y aspect. They give kids access to interactive exhibits, afternoons in the Omnimax Theater, explosive demonstrations, ooey-gooey hands-on experimentation, and it's a brand of science that they deliver for entire week segments. So might be a good way to educate, entertain, and generally keep your kid busy for a week this summer. And that's at Science World. Another thing that's coming up is a symposium for women entering ecology and evolution today, or SWEET. And that is on May 11th, 2008, this symposium. It's being sponsored by SWIST, and it's a symposium intended to address issues that influence the advancement of women from postgraduate degrees into academic, government, and industry positions, specifically in ecology and evolution. And there have been some very scholarly and academic reports recently on the issues unique to women on that career trajectory, and it's great to see that there's a symposium addressing those issues. Additionally, we're talking a lot about science and art and where they commingle, and the Vancouver Art Gallery has a pretty cool exhibition coming up called Crazy, beginning May 17th. It looks at the delirious world of anime, comics, video games, and art. It's the first exhibition of its kind, apparently a groundbreaking project that offers unique and dynamic insight into the world of comics, animated cartoons, anime, manga, graphic novels, computer video games, and visual art. And it's going to span a century of art making. Looks like a really vibrant exhibition, and will include also a lot of great talks. So you can find more about that at the Vancouver Art Gallery website. Additionally, Science World is braving the challenge of talking about music in a way that's directly linked to Disney's music. So they have an exhibition opening in June called Disney: The Music Behind the Magic. Clearly, music plays a central role in human culture. It's a means of communication, it can carry rich information about our surroundings, it can create mood, it can create emotion, and it's important in constructing our memories and worldview. Disney has created some very memorable music in the 20th and 21st century, which is definitely an influence in our culture, and it's of particular scientific interest to consider why and how that works. At Science World, visitors will journey through the history of film music and allow them to experiment with Foley techniques, remixing, and interactive games all around the music of Disney. So definitely give that a thought. Julia will be with you in 2 weeks' time with another fantastic science and technology show as a part of My Science Project. Coming up next is Darren with Stereoscopic Readout. And myself, I'll be back in 4 weeks' time with a little bit more on generative art. And I'll leave you now with music from Steve Reich, remixed by Howie B. This is 8 Lions.